Well, hello everyone. Welcome to Coaches on the Couch. I'm Louise.
And I'm Rachel.
And today we're joined by Luke Tozer of Pittman Tozer and Jacob Wilson and Sarah Beth Riley of Be First. And among other things, we're going to be exploring some aspects of the client-architect relationship and how, in particular, things have changed over the last year. But before we get into that, we need to talk couches. Please tell us something interesting about your couch. And Luke, as you're actually sitting on yours, and we've already commented that we're very impressed by your dedication to the theme, perhaps you could tell us something about the couch that you're sitting on.
Thank you. Well, this couch has been with us for almost 20 years and is one of the pieces of furniture that was in our small flat before we built Gap House and moved when we moved. And it's seen a lot. It's had two babies, now become two large teenage boys. I think I've slept on it many times. And I think my favorite moments were probably watching Match of the Day with my firstborn in my arms, doing the sort of night feed or the Match of the Day feed. But it's yet to be recovered, which it probably should be. But other than that, it's held up pretty well for 20 years. Lots of fond memories.
That's a couch with significant memories built into it, which is lovely.
Absolutely.
Okay, so Sarah Beth, let's come to you next.
Okay, so our couch is fairly new, but it does have about a 15 centimetre incision because our couch is extremely multifunctional. It's a couch, it's also a sofa bed where our guests sleep, and because we're doing a flat renovation, it's also our workbench. So my partner's been through it with a Stanley knife, hence the incision.
And did stuff that was supposed to be inside the couch come outside the couch?
It's not actually, it's held up pretty well. I should probably sew it up, to be honest, but it's laziness on my part.
And Jacob, last but not least.
Yeah, so I've got two cats and two kids. So I have a very robust IKEA L-shaped couch. And it has a lot of special memories for me. And I think, you know, thinking about Luke's theme of relating those to children, My daughter, my second child, was born at home, and it's where we had our first cuddles right after where she was born. So it has a special place in my heart for that.
Lovely.
Lovely stories. I feel all warm and fuzzy.
That's a nice way to start, isn't it?
Yeah. So some quick introductions. Pittman Tozer was co-founded by Luke Tozer and Tim Pittman in 2002. And the practice has an expanding portfolio of projects for the private and public clients, from large master plan regeneration and housing schemes, private homes, to more modest but no less important community and civic buildings. Luke, you trained at the Glasgow School of Art and in Cambridge, and one of your best known projects is the design and delivery of the Manson Medal winning Gap House, where you are now, no doubt, living with your family. So that must have been an interesting client-architect relationship. Maybe we'll return to that. But you also obviously lead many of the practice's larger housing projects. And we chat to a lot of cyclists on this podcast, and I think you might be another member of that fraternity.
Yes, I am. And in fact, I'm sat on the couch below the mezzanine where my bike is on its sort of static turbo trainer that the start of each day in lockdown between 7 and 8. There's a group of us who meet up on Zoom and cycle on Zwift for an hour each morning. So,
great, very good.
Yes.
And Pittman Tozer's client list includes some of the country's leading social housing providers, including Be First, where Jacob Wilson is head of design and Sarah Beth Riley is associate architect. Be First is an urban regeneration company wholly owned by Barking and Dagenham Council, but operating independently.
And Jacob, you're both an urban designer and a planner with big practice experience gained at Levitt Bernstein and local authority experience as principal planner at the London Borough of Camden. And you joined Be First in September 2019, and I think you took up your current role in February 2020. And one of your first tasks has been to build a delivery team, a around you. And Sarah Beth Riley joined BeFirst last year from Lewisham Homes. And Sarah, you've worked on social housing projects from infill to large-scale estate regeneration, and for a number of practices, including HTA and Ash Sacula, before joining BeFirst. So that's quite a long introduction, but we felt that it was necessary in this case. And you came together, these two teams came together to deliver the 226 home third phase of the Gascoigne Estate, a net zero scheme approved by Barking and Dagenham Council in September 2020.
So on to the theme of today. As Louise said earlier, we're really interested in the sort of relationship between client and architect. And there are a couple of specific things that led us to invite you onto the couch today. One was we wanted to explore how you manage the transition from in real life to virtual working at such a critical point in the gestation of such a large scheme like Gascoigne. And the other is how you feel that leaders can support their teams to adjust to new ways of working so that these are sustainable moving forward. So before we jump into that, it would be really good to start off with a bit of background on how you all sort of came to be leaders within your current roles. So Jacob, maybe we could come to you first. Maybe you could give us a bit of background and your story on how you came to head design at BeFirst.
Yeah, thank you, Rachel. So I've worked, as you've touched on, I've worked in both private and public sector, but I think what I'm really passionate about is the role of public sector design teams and the roles they can play in really being a custodian of place and having an intimate knowledge of their local authority. And, you know, over the last year, I've been building a design team at BeFirst, so working with our managing director, Pat Hayes, to build that team. And we've had a lot of conversations around, you know, the form of that team, the structure of that team, and the role of that team. And I think what's really important, you know, for the design team at BeFirst is, you know, that we're going to be initiators of projects, enabling projects, and guardian of projects. So I think my experience of working both in practice before, but working on the public sector side as well, has really informed that work and how we build that team to really take that step forward.
I think it's a really interesting question, firstly, because I'm not sure I see myself as a leader yet. I definitely still see myself as kind of emerging or something to that effect. I think, like Jacob, you know, I worked in the private sector and the public sector, and I really felt like architects in the public sector can help to push, help to make decisions, and help architecture teams outside designing the buildings to, you know, reach the full potential. In a way, we can make it a bit easier for architecture teams by making a much more robust brief, or by kind of encouraging colleagues at the local authority to think about things differently. So I think that's how I kind of lead internally within BeFirst.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I used to be quite interested in the role of, most boroughs used to have borough architects who oversaw, I used to work for Southwark many, many years ago, who oversaw how the local authority developed its social housing. And then that role sort of disappeared. I think probably Luke will know better than me about this, but I think probably in the early 80s, that role seemed to disappear. And design review panels came in as a way of kind of overseeing design issues in the borough. And then with BeFirst and others of your ilk, it's kind of gone full circle.
I'm really keen to hear what Luke has to say about it, because when we talk about the architect-client relationship, what does it mean when that client's now an architect?
Well, I think coming back firstly to the sort of custodian point, I guess, as Louise pointed out, when the removal of borough architects who had formerly kind of performed that function, I think for many years, you know, there was an absence of building social housing for a start. Perhaps there wasn't a need in the same way for the role because of a post-Thatcher drive towards home ownership and away from social housing. But the reality is, you know, quite different today. And I think the housing companies like BeFirst are necessarily taking that function and that role and making it their own. The fact that it's being led by architects, quite frankly, does make our role easier. It was much more difficult when we were working with local authorities. Previously, they didn't have any architects involved, and it was project managers and quantity surveyors who were leading. So I think the sort of long-term thinking, the urban design thinking, the custodianship, as Jacob mentioned, is uniquely, you know, architects and urban designers bring to it, that is absolutely should be at the core of kind of long-term patient placemaking for the public good. You know, it's public money that's being spent. It's the public who deserves to reap the benefits over the next 30, 50, 100 years. And I think having that architectural and urban design perspective on it is absolutely critical. It's, you know, of course it has to stack up financially, it has to do all of those things, but if you've not got at the center of it the vision that the place needs to be improved over the long term, then you're always fighting an uphill battle. So in short, having architects and urban designers as clients does make our life easier, because I think there's a shared purpose and a kind of shared vision, which is why it's so much fun.
I think just building on that, we like to think we put in a lot of the groundwork as designers to allow the projects to fly. So, you know, it's really important that we work at the early stages to think about the brief, you know, the quantum of homes, the viability study for the schemes going forward, and to put in that legwork up front. So we have a really firm brief that our architects can work to. You know, Sarah, since she's been joining us, been doing loads of work on our employers' requirements, thinking about management and maintenance, and thinking about the longevity of the projects over the lifespan. So we're doing a lot of work around the project, you know, either side, you know, before we commission architects, and then how we take the project on following when the architects go. So working with our contractors, you know, thinking about how our residents move into the building, thinking about the management and maintenance over the lifespan of the building. And I think that's what I see is really important. It's really important to have a design thinking in those work areas that work around the actual, you know, REBA stage 1 to 3 of designing a project.
There's a couple of things just on that story through there that I just want to come back to. The first one, I'm just going to come back to Sarah. And so I was really interested in you saying you see yourself as an emerging leader. I just wonder, what is the point that you feel you've arrived as a leader?
I'm not sure of the answer yet, but I can get back to you. I think, you know, something I've really experienced in our team as Jacob set it up is that the hierarchy is quite flat. That's not something I've experienced in private practice in architecture before, but I think there's a real kind of equality across the team, and it's not about kind of linear progression and becoming the senior architect, becoming the associate, becoming the head. You know, we all see ourselves completely equal at the table, and all of our comments and values are considered and incorporated into the design team as a whole, and that's not something I've necessarily experienced before.
Yeah, we're hearing that a lot. That's really why I picked up on the point, because I think people are leaders before they think they're leaders, because historically there's been that hierarchical setting within organizations and within project teams, and I think that's shifting a bit, isn't it? So yeah, we're all kind of leaders, or you're a leader as soon as there's people following, or whatever measure there may be of leadership. I think that's shifting. So interesting point. Luke, I just wanted to give you the opportunity just to talk a little bit about your sort of journey into leadership at Pitman Tozer, just before we move on.
Well, I guess when Tim and I set up in 2002, it was just Tim and I, and over the last 19 years, we've had, you know, a gradual increase in staff. So I've been, I guess, gradually developing some of the skills. I entirely empathize with Sarah. I don't think, I think whilst I am inherently de facto leader of the practice and I've got my name above the door, I would still consider myself emerging in terms of learning the tools of leadership. And I think it's an ongoing challenge, because frankly, the size of the organization is never static, and people join us and people move on. And there's a, you know, the dynamic of different projects means, you know, it's one of the pleasures of running a studio and being an architect is it's never the same 2 days in a row. So it's constantly evolving.
Yeah, I think that's an important point, isn't it, within the industry and the sort of setup that we're in, that because a lot of people lead teams that are reasonably static, I guess. You know, there's churn obviously in on internal teams, but built environment means you're leading several projects with several different teams. I think that's sort of an interesting difference perhaps within our sector.
Let's think about the project that you both work on, because when you started working on this project, presumably there were, because one of the things about having urban designers and architects within Be First must be that you speak the same language as the architects that you're working with. So there must have been a period of time before COVID when there were in-person meetings and relationships were formed, and there was design conversations that were passionate and exciting, and maybe there was a little bit of even conflict and conflicting views and sorting those out, but you then managed to get towards a scheme that was ready to be prepared for planning, and then everything went a bit pear-shaped. So let's ask Jacob first, what was the experience of working on a big project like that? And I know there were others you were working on when everybody suddenly had to stop that in-person collaboration and communication and creativity in real life with architects.
Yeah, so I mean, it was a big challenge at first. I mean, I think the project that we talk about here, 3A on Gap, I think we were fortunate that a significant amount of the work was done pre-COVID. So we had built those relationships. You know, we had done the team building with the huge technical team, with Luke's team, with the Be First team, all through physical meetings, going to coffee shops, going for lunch, going to the pub, etc. So I think that momentum and those established relationships and patterns of behavior really helped then going into the virtual world, and it allowed the project actually to continue at speed, because it was a critical point in the process. I think the things that we really missed was, you know, having tracing paper on the table, doing the drawings, standing around the models. I mean, we've used models a lot with this project, so standing around the models and using that as a tool to develop the design, we really missed. And I think moving into the digital world, into the virtual world, and having meetings, things became more, you know, present and comment, and you kind of miss that dynamism that you have in DTMs when you're all around the table. So that was tricky, but I think because we had the established relationships, we could still continue with the project. A lot of the design had actually been developed to a state, you know, we passed the concept stage, we were working on the details. So yeah, I think with other projects, it's been more tricky where we haven't had that established relationship. So I've had other projects, you know, where we've commissioned the team, we've put out the brief over the last year and commissioned the team virtually. We've had the inception meeting virtually, and then we've gone through all the DTMs virtually to deliver the project. And where we're doing that without that established pattern of behavior, without those established relationships that you get in the through physical meetings, it's a lot bigger challenge.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. I think there's a level of trust that's you know, we had already built up on the project amongst the team. And if you're talking about the kind of architect client relationship, it frankly is easier to build that, you know, in person over the coffees and over the drinks at the end of the day than it is via a Zoom call. The assumed level of trust and between us was already high, and so we could all carry on, as Jacob mentioned. I think it would have been much more difficult had we conceived and sort of won the project during lockdown. It would have been, I suspect we probably would have had to have had many more meetings to give everyone the trust and kind of, I think Jacob knows that we've, you know, knows where the project is going, and Sarah know where the project is heading and what the issues are and how we as a team are looking after them, which frankly, from a, you know, as a leader of the practice, it's much more difficult to understand all of the components, all of the different projects that are running simultaneously within the studio when they're remote. I have to make the active, you know, I have to arrange a team catch-up meeting and have lots of them rather than walk with my cup of coffee up and down the studio and chat to people.
This is something that's come up in other conversations, that where there's been pre-existing relationships, the way that we've all been working has continued to work, to continue to flourish. But it's almost like then you get to the exhausting of those virtual relationships, and we all need to have a little bit more in real life. And of course, so you started during lockdown, didn't you? That must have been, so you started on the project and in a new role during the pandemic, during lockdown. How was that to kind of get to grips with the new project? I don't know whether you've actually met person to person.
Yeah, we have. So yeah, I started during lockdown. Jacob and I had my kind of kickoff inception meeting at our local city farm with the resident cockerel, which was quite interesting. So we did manage to meet. I'd say maybe I've met Jacob 5 times. I know Luke from before. But starting the project during lockdown was really interesting because it had already been submitted for planning when I joined. And the first time I think Luke and I maybe met was during the contractor kickoff meeting even. So starting the relationship with yet another party as part of the project as well was particularly difficult. I think it's been much harder.
I think it's been helped. It was helped by the fact that Sarah and I knew each other from before. We had to establish that relationship online and build the level of trust. I think that was already there.
Have you found new ways? I mean, we've talked about various different things there, the sort of building trust and relationships and the creativity and collaboration, the standing around the models. I mean, if this was to carry on forever, which obviously it's not going to, but have you established new ways of being able to do those things, or can you see new ways that those things might happen?
We've been discussing this with Jacob and Sarah. They've got a good iPad system that hopefully you can, they can tell us more about, because I think we might implement that. I still personally prefer at the early stages the fat pen and tracing paper and the sketch, you know, the sketch models rather than the virtual models. They are getting better and better. I mean, it's much more advanced now than it would have been. You know, frankly, I don't know how we would have coped if we'd had this pandemic even 5 years ago.
No, you know?
What do you mean? It is workable, and I assume if we were faced with the same thing in 5 years' time, it would be even more workable. But last week, where we had 7 people in the studio because we had various site visits and things that people needed to pick up PPE equipment and things, and actually it was a complete joy. People were giggling and chatting and clearly enjoying themselves, and we rounded off the day with some drinks in a way that it's impossible to replicate properly online. So I'm looking forward to the few weeks, months time when we're able to get more and more people back.
Yeah, one of the things that I've been thinking about quite a lot recently, and I've spoken to Jacob about this outside of this forum, is that the difficulty with the constant interruptions of another call, and as you say, Luke, you have to be more intentional about catching up with people, so that means there's more scheduled calls, kind of limiting the time that you have to get really into the flow of design, the kind of, you know, the time, as you say, with the tracing paper, and flow is such an, you know, it's one of the principles of positive psychology, that being in the flow, having that time when you're not thinking about anything else and can be completely at one with what you're doing and kind of lose that self-consciousness that you can do when you're really absorbed in something. How are you finding the space to carry on being in the flow in this environment?
I think that has been a big challenge, and it's something that we're talking a lot about in our team. I think, you know, the Be First design team, we're not spending all our time designing. You know, we're a client team. We work with our planning team. We work with our commercial team. So we are stretched and we pulled into different areas. But we also do a lot of design. And I think the biggest challenge for us is, you know, as we've moved into the virtual world, is just this being inundated with so many meetings because you don't have those chance encounters around the office. And, you know, our diaries get very full. And I think we're thinking about how to overcome that, and whether, you know, we set aside time where we're not going to do meetings, whether that's in the afternoon or a day a week. But I think we feel it's really important to have that loose space in our calendar where you can really get your head into a project and not be interrupted by the teams or the Zooms or the calls or the meetings, and just really get the head down. So that does feel really important to us, and I don't think we have necessarily solved that within our team yet.
Does anyone else have that My Analytics tool? It tells me every week that I'm spending between 75% and 80% of my time collaborating. That means 20% of my time is free time, not in meetings, not doing emails, not on chat. I couldn't believe that. And it stresses me out so much because the time I find I have is half an hour here, 15 minutes there. And how am I supposed to do any work in that time? I think starting this job in lockdown, the way my entire role has been set up is doing lots of projects and lots of things outside of projects, which mean that I'm back to back basically all of the time. And like Jacob said, we're trying to work through how we can change those things. But at the moment, not even putting, you know, design work, no meetings in your calendar, that just doesn't work at the moment. So we're working through it.
Yeah, I've turned that analytics tool off. I find it too annoying.
Well, that's one way of dealing with it, Luke.
I think that in the short term, the putting in advance chunks of time in your diary that where people can't put meetings is probably the best tactic, being unavailable for other things, you know, or unavailable for meetings to get that sort of that space. But I frankly to me, design is best done and most enjoyable as a collaboration, and Tim and I, you know, still have the most fun working together on projects and designs, and discussing, developing designs and bouncing ideas off each other and other members of the studio. So that is, you have to be much more deliberate about, and design workshops are more difficult.
Can I come back to the previous question that Rachel, you asked, just about the longer term implications of COVID and how we're going to work with our architects? I think that's something that we're also thinking about now. And you know, for us previously, being a client, you know, such a big part of our role was going around London. I used to love kind of cycling to all the different architects' offices, you know, to do the DTMs, and that was such a big part of the job. And I think moving to home working and moving to virtual working, you know, we've condensed that so much. So the projects are moving quicker. You know, instead of having one DTM in the afternoon, we're probably having two DTMs back to back in the afternoon. And I don't know, you know, how much of that's going to change. I think, you know, we will have some physical DTMs, but I think the productivity's gone up. It saves a lot of, you know, people commuting, people moving around. I think there are some real benefits to that in terms of how our projects move forward. But what it's really made me think about, you know, working with Luke has worked really well because we had that established relationship, and it's been more difficult with new practices that we're working with, or younger practices that we're working with, where we don't have those relationships. So for me, what seems really important is that we work with build a collegiate group of architects that we work with, and really think about those relationships and build those relationships outside of projects. So have more specific events with a smaller group of architects that we work with, and build those relationships that way, that then allow our projects to move at pace, allow our projects to kind of work successfully in the digital realm. So I think that's how I see it as a potential way going forward.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Because that's kind of how people are starting to think, and a single organisation is starting to think about bringing people together for collaboration. And you're thinking about that on a project-wide basis with lots of different teams. That's really interesting shift.
Yeah, and I think so. We would have those events, you know, around topics that I think that we need to learn, you know, where we need to learn as a client, but also our architects need to learn, our contractors need to learn. You know, thinking about sustainability, delivering zero carbon buildings, circular economy principles, all these things, I think, as an industry, we need to move together. Yeah. We need to learn together. So let's do that as a collective with all our partners. And then, you know, let's just, the projects kind of work separate from that and can move at pace, can move in the virtual world. So I think there's further thinking that we need to do there. But I think, you know, things will change off the back of this. And maybe that is a future way of working.
Luke, would you add anything to that?
Well, I definitely think there are significant advantages in different stages of doing things online, and the practices that we've all sort of established during lockdown have made certain stages and DTMs and things way more efficient, as Jacob mentioned. So I think those will stay and should stay. The sort of idea that we end up with some hybrid is an interesting one, probably where we have collaboration days. I mean, if we're talking back to how do we get that space to think and flow in terms of design, it's probably going to be a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and it's probably going to be people coming in to do those sorts of things and working remotely from home 2 or 3 days a week doing the other things, the DTMs, the perhaps less collaborative and more procedural elements of the job. So it's about reorganizing things to enable that, and it probably partly depends on the different stages of the job as well. So I think that's, you know, how we're thinking about how the studio might be set up to enable that. And actually, the bit that doesn't work terribly well, even with a relatively small number of people in at various stages, is lots of Zoom calls in the studio the studio at the same time. You just get the constant background noise of somebody else talking in another meeting, and it's really, or even worse, if you're on the same meeting, you hear them, and then you hear them another half second later. So you get the sort of echo. So actually, it may be that the studio is a non-Zoom environment, then people go and have their Zoom meetings at home.
Lots of thinking and conversations, I think, to take place both within your organisations and generally around what are we going to leave behind from this period? What are we going to take with us? And how are we going to make some of the things that really work during this period work even better as we go forward in the hybrid world? And I think there are a lot of conversations to happen around that. And it's really good to hear that you're already starting all that thinking. So that's great. If you had to take one lesson from this period to take forward, what would it be?
I think it's really kind of taught me to prioritize. You know, there's times when things are triple stacked in my diary and a decision has to be made about where my time is best spent. And I think more than ever, I felt like, you know, I should be everywhere at once and I need to keep on top of everything. But I think there's just a point where you have to really think about it, prioritize and spend your time where it's best spent.
Yeah, I think there's lots of lessons over the last year, but I think the most important for me is coming back to this building relationships to enable successful collaboration in this new way of working. I think that's where we'll be spending a lot of our time, thinking about how we do that as a company, how we do that as an internal design team, and how we do that with the external teams that we want to work with, both established ones, but also new teams that we want to bring in to work with us.
I've probably initially found most challenging, which has kind of precipitated some changes in the way we work, was letting go, having to not being able to do the casual, informal leadership and design development in the studio in the same place, and how to then reorganize to be able to do that remotely. So I think trying to then, in a hybrid world, tease out of those things that can be organized and sort of delegated and separated, and then those things that are done informally or you come together to do. I think that's the challenge of the way that we're thinking about the future.
The rethinking of how you do certain things that you did so naturally within the office, I think, is really interesting. So prioritisation, building relationships, and that sort of rethinking around how you manage certain aspects, I think, is great. And I think brings us to the end of the conversation. Really enjoyed the conversation this morning. Thank you all. It's been lovely to see you.
Yes, thank you.
Likewise.
Yeah, enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you.
And you. Thanks for inviting us.